It was 1954. Television was live. And Benji Stone landed the job of his dreams as a TV comedy writer.
Alice, what are we seeing?
Alan Swan's movies.
It was the year Hollywood's greatest hero swashbuckled his way onto live TV and into Benji's life.
He's blasted.
Good God, it's Renfield.
I thought he was dead.
Swan better be at every rehearsal sober, or it's your neck.
They've asked me to stay with you and help you over some of the rough spots.
Like showing up?
That's one. Another is not passing out.
What sort of heroic idiot am I this time?
A musketeer idiot.
I read that on the airplane. Very funny. Very good.
I wrote that.
Did you? Bravo, Stan. Bravo.
How about the store club? We'll be two for dinner.
Oh no, Mr. Swan, this is exactly the way it started last time.
And you know, I'm supposed to watch you.
Good, watch this.
Now all we have to do is to get from here to there. I'm going down now. Oh, have a lunch.
5 minutes to air.
This is places, people!
Sure, this is live television.
Live.
What are you doing?
Drinking and leaving!
Take it!
So, I'm afraid.
The flesh and blood, life-size, no larger. I'm not that silly damned hero I never was.
To me, you were. You couldn't have convinced me unless you had that courage. Nobody's that good an actor.
I'm not an actor, I'm a movie star.
Alan Swan may have been the worst person to look up to, but it was the best time Benji ever had.
It's 30 years for this.
My favorite year.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me once again is my pal, movie producer Corey Musa. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for having me.
I'm happy to have you back. Now, you were on the last episode of the show with some of the gang talking about Spider-Man No Way Home. This movie we're going to be talking about today is about as far away from that as humanly possible. We're going to be doing an audio commentary track for the 1982 movie My Favorite Year, starring Peter O'Toole and Mark Lynn Baker. This movie celebrates its 40th anniversary this year. It's a particular favorite of yours, Corey, right?
It certainly is. And to be fair, Rob, Spider-Man No Way Home and My Favorite Year both take place in Manhattan. So,
wow. Okay.
They give you that connection right
there.
That's
a really very large Venn diagram. So we have a lot to say about this movie, but we'll get into all that as we're commenting on it. You can find this movie on Amazon. You can rent it different platforms. It's available on Blu-ray and DVD. And so if you have not seen this movie, we definitely recommend you go out and get it. It's a lot of fun, and then watch it. Then you can come back and listen to us talk over it. If you have seen it, hopefully you will enjoy this commentary. And Corey, I'm feeling confident. I think we're going to get this in one take.
I think we are too. I mean, we are one take wonders. Isn't that what they say about us?
That's right.
The fans.
The fans. Yes, absolutely. So as we normally do for these commentary tracks, I'm going to count down, do 3, 2, 1, and Corey and I will start playing the movie. There is only one cut of this film available. It is 92 minutes and 17 seconds long. So nobody has to worry about having some alternate version we don't know about. So Corey, if you're ready, I will count down. I will say 3, 2, 1, and then go. And then we will start the movie.
I'm ready when you are.
All right, so let's do it. So 3, 2, 1, go. And we've got our MGM logo here, which sadly has now been replaced by a digital lion, which is just very tragic.
Oh. Do you think actual harm came to that lion?
Probably, but I hope not. So, okay, this movie, Corey, when did you first see this movie? Because I didn't see it in the theater, even though I was at the age where I was seeing a lot of movies with my dad and my sister. But I saw this when this came to cable. And man, they played this thing ad nauseum. I mean, they just, I must have seen this movie a dozen times just because the local cable channel played it over and over and over. When did you first see it?
I definitely would have seen it in its cable run. I didn't see it in the theaters, but when I was a kid, I guess probably in the late 80s, yeah, they ran the hell out of this, and I saw it more than a few times. And it had like a the impression it burned in my mind was deep and long, and I've carried it with me ever since. So.
Now, what was it about that struck you so much? Was it that it was set in the world of show business? I mean, what
how did that? Well, I mean, the movie is, like, for anybody that doesn't know, it's a love letter to New York City. It's a love letter to old Hollywood. It has very much like some Mel Brooks or Woody Allen sensibilities to it, and or even more specifically, like some Neil Simon to it. And for me, I'm a young, you know, Jewish kid in South Florida. And all my family had come from New York, and this was all just very relatable to me. I could identify with our protagonist of this story, Benji Stone.
Benji Stone, sure.
Played by none other than Mark Linn-Baker.
Mark, this is his first film. This is introducing Mark Linn-Baker. And this is something that's always amazed me about how Hollywood works. And again, maybe you could speak to this because you have a lot of experience in that. But I'm amazed that someone can star in a movie. And this is even true of American Werewolf in London, which we did a commentary track for just a couple episodes ago, where someone can star in a movie, be given such an amazing platform, and yet it doesn't seem to really do much for them in terms of a movie career. Because Mark Linn-Baker, of course, most famous for Perfect Strangers, that he did with Bronson Pinchot for like 6 or 7 seasons. And that was a massively successful show. But like this was, outside of Peter O'Toole, this thing is such a showcase for this actor. And yet if you look at his IMDb profile, he basically did not do another movie. He just went right to television. And it's Hollywood seems so cruel that you can have this kind of presentation. And yet it doesn't, for some people, it just doesn't do much for their career.
Well, Mark Linn-Baker, you know, it opened the door wide for him to be cast in Perfect Strangers, which he was then busy doing for the next like 7 years. And he became a household name on that television show. And he appeared in a few really cool movies afterwards. Noises Off is like one of my other favorite films. And he is wonderful in that movie.
He's great in this. He's really charming. And I mean, again, what this movie is kind of such a two-hander with him and Peter O'Toole, because the great, legendary Peter O'Toole, who was just coming off of another movie called The Stuntman, which is about Hollywood, a much darker view of Hollywood. But he had done two films. This is his second film in a row. Set in the world of show business. And one of the things I enjoy about this movie is the sort of meta-ness of it, is that all the actors in this movie, we'll go through them all. We see a few of them here. We see Bill Macy from Maude, Bill Macy is, I think, the reason why William H. Macy is billed as William H. Macy, because yes, there was a Bill Macy. But like
they
all
are
the,
not the same person.
Not the same person at all. This man is not married to Felicity Huffman. But all of these actors are all either TV actors or commercial actors, or none of these people are particularly movie stars exactly, except for one small exception, which we'll get to in a moment. But I love how that kind of works, and that, of course, everyone in this movie is amazed to be working with this genuine movie star, Alan Swan, played by Peter O'Toole. And I think that was probably the reality when they're making the movie, was that everybody was probably so amazed to be working with they're sitting here working with Lawrence of Arabia, for Pete's sakes.
Oh yeah. No, there's some definite meta elements to this movie that they were, you know, there's definitely some elements of the character that Peter O'Toole plays, Alan Swan, that, you know, is very Peter O'Toole. And O'Toole is basically supposed to be playing this character, Alan Swan, who is basically based loosely on Errol Flynn.
Yeah, yeah. Mel Brooks, who produced this film, by the way, you mentioned Mel Brooks earlier. He actually did produce this film. He mentioned that this was loosely based on the time that Errol Flynn guest starred on the Sid Caesar Show of Shows. And it was funny, I went and looked that up, and I could not find any IMDb credit where it said Errol Flynn was ever on your Show of Shows. So I don't know whether that is true or not, or IMDb is just incomplete or whatever. But yeah, this is clearly
Hollywood rumors.
He clearly meant to be Errol Flynn. And by the way, we in the earlier scene, we saw some clips from Alan Swan's movie, which they will, Benji will be referencing Captain from Tortuga and things like that. And I love that they look like genuine Technicolor adventure films. That had to be really fun for Richard Benjamin to shoot, is these clips of these old timey Hollywood movies that don't exist.
Hey, there's something to be said for this film about, you know, this movie was made in the 1980s. It does like an excellent job of capturing two different versions of old Hollywood. You know, one in like the 1950s, 1954 to be exact, which is the year this takes place in, his favorite year, which honestly, I looked up 1954 and I'm like, I don't know, was this a great year for everybody else? Or just you? I think there was a vaccination for polio came out this year, so that was something to celebrate for sure.
We're also celebrating that that all of America got it. Something we can celebrate.
Oh, boy. So, yeah, here we are with this film.
So we said we've got Bill Macy here, who we know from Maud. I think that's the thing he's most famous for. You've got Basil Hoffman, character actor Basil Hoffman, who just passed away just last year, 2021. He had 135 credits. I know him from two different appearances in MASH. He played two different characters on MASH, of course, but he was in tons of movies. He was recently in Hail Caesar with the Coen brothers. He was in The Artist. I mean, just one of these guys that just showed up in a million things. And then the secretary here, not the secretary, one of the writers is Anne DeSalvo, who was in Arthur and Stardust Memories, among a lot of other things. So these are all people with, you know, tons of credits, tons of experience playing these sort of, hard-won, comedy writers. Oh, and here's Jessica Harper, the lovely and talented Jessica Harper from Suspiria.
I love Jessica Harper. I've had a crush on Jessica Harper since I was born. So
now she was in Shock Treatment, right? The sequel to Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is, I've never seen that movie, but you love it, right?
I love Shock Treatment, and I knew that movie before I actually knew this movie, and I knew Suspiria before I knew this movie. So I knew she was like somebody I actually knew going into this movie. And she also actually stars in Brian De Palma's first film, I think, Phantom of the Paradise. So Jessica Harper is in a couple of musicals. She's got quite a voice.
What an eclectic career.
And we just missed our little cameo that she pops in and out of the movie from Selma Diamond.
Yes.
Who you all might remember from the sitcom Night Court.
One of the most distinctive voices ever. She is Captain Culpepper's wife in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
Right.
We never see her, but we hear her. Spencer Tracy talked to her on the phone. And she actually worked on your Show of Shows. So she was on that show, and here she is playing a part of it. But she's playing the costume designer. Like I said, we've got now. Again, so all this 50s stuff, this appealed to you as a kid, all this sort of period flavor?
It really did. Well, you know, I was a huge fan of classic TV when I was growing up. And the Dick Van Dyke Show was one of my favorite television shows to watch when I was a kid in reruns. And, you know, for me, like, I always felt like this was about Dick Van Dyke, even though I knew as I grew up, it was more about really Sid Caesar. You know, Dick Van Dyke Show was really based on the Sid Caesar Show as well, or the Show of Shows. Sid Caesar's your Show of Shows. and then here comes King Kaiser.
Joseph Bologna.
Played by Joseph Bologna, who I also love and I think is so well cast in this movie as this Sid Caesar type of character. What do people know this man from? The thing that I always knew him from when I was a kid was there was an episode of Married with Children that was like a backdoor pilot for another sitcom that he starred on with him and Matt LeBlanc played father and son.
Oh, wow. I remember that. Yes.
It was called Top of the Heap or something like
that. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was something he was in, which is just so funny. And, he was
the voice of Dan Turpin on the Superman animated series.
The Superman animated series.
Yeah. The Bruce Timm show. He was Dan Turpin. He was the voice. He's great in this because he doesn't look like Sid Caesar, but he looks like Sid Caesar, if that makes any sense. He has Sid Caesar's physicality, his bigness, because Sid Caesar was a big guy and was very physical, and Bologna carries himself like that. So you totally buy that he's the star of this TV show.
He's so funny in this. He's just like abusive to his employees, and then he buys them things.
Get him some tires. Get him some White Wall tires. I love the cigar that he's got, the prop cigar here, which is the size of a baton at this point.
Giant gangster suit with the big shoulder pads.
Yeah, this is great.
And they're basically doing a sketch right now that on the comedy show, and they're making fun of this local gangster named Boss Hijack.
Rojack. In the sketch, it's Hijack, but it's Rojack in the reality of it. And by the way, this whole running bit with Basil Hoffman's character, the writer who never talks, he always kind of whispers, Herb. He always whispers into Alice's ear, and then she says it. That's a thing that apparently Larry Gelbart did, or no, Neil Simon. Neil Simon would do that. He couldn't. He felt that the writer's room was so noisy that he would just mutter to someone off to the side, and it would then that would get his word out. But he would never actually speak out loud. Apparently, that's a bit that they took from that and put it and gave it to.
That's so funny.
Yeah,
he's great. He's the mute, and he has his final line at the end of the movie. He finally speaks at the end, sums it all up. So here we have them reviewing this old footage. That is, they've recreated these kind of Robin Hood movies. This entrance right now, Peter O'Toole makes his entrance into the film right now, and you see why he's nominated for an Academy Award for this film. He gives just an amazing physical performance from him throughout this entire film, and it starts from the moment he walks on screen.
Permanently pickled, sort of, just hanging it together. Do you remember when you saw this movie? Were you familiar with him at all? Had you seen him in anything, or was this your introduction?
My introduction to Peter O'Toole, and this is how I've always thought of Peter O'Toole ever since. Like, he's my hero.
That's a great pratfall he does on the table. Yeah, years later, he would start appearing on David Letterman, the Late Night with Letterman show, and he would just tell old stories. And I think it was he must have had something to promote, but I think he just started telling old stories about, hanging out with Richard Harris or Richard Burton. And Letterman got so charmed by it that I remember he just started coming back every so often and just told stories. It wasn't even like you had anything to promote. It was just, okay, Peter, tell us stories about old Hollywood. And he would just tell these amazing tales of getting, pie-eyed with these legendary actors in the theater and stuff. And it, in a weird way, it's almost like he fused with his Alan Swan persona, which is kind of like he became that guy of like, oh, he's this charming drunk guy who just comes and tells you great stories.
That is the Peter O'Toole I grew up kind of thinking of as before I had seen, like Lawrence of Arabia or anything else. He was Alan Swan to me first. So, and I remember those stories he used to tell about him and Richard Harris just getting shit-faced. it's the stuff of legend. It's really funny. So this movie plays on that, though, and that's why he's very well cast in this film.
He's incredibly charming. He's just real, and you buy him in the footage. Those movies look real. They don't look like parodies. They look, again, I like that they've been kind of color graded a little to give them that slightly faded Technicolor look, and all the sets and stuff. And so Again, like I said, Richard Benjamin must have had a fun time shooting that. By the way, this was Richard Benjamin, who, of course, had been an actor for many years, for decades. This is his first film as director. He had directed a couple of TV episodes, but this was his first feature film, and it's an incredibly assured first film. I mean, he really, you know, he nails the tone. He seems to know exactly what he's going for. And this led to a very successful directorial career. I mean, he went on to do Racing with the Moon with Diane Keaton. He did City Heat with, well, which was not a hit, but it was a big movie. Clint Eastwood and Burt Reynolds, The Money Pit with Tom Hanks, yeah. Mermaids with Cher. I mean, and you know, he continued to direct into the 2000s. I think he's kind of mostly retired now, and occasionally he'll pop up in something as an actor. But I mean, this was really the beginning of him having a genuine directorial career.
I think it's really impressive that this got to be his. This is a cool movie to make as a first movie, and such a love letter too.
Now he directed a TV movie adaptation of Laughter on the 23rd Floor, which was Neil Simon's play about working on Your Show of Shows.
Right.
So he ended up doing that here as well. Now, by the way, I want to mention this, the guy playing the producer, Leo, is Adolph Green. And Adolph Green was not really an actor. He was in a couple of things, but this is by far his biggest credit. He was mostly known as a writer. He co-wrote On the Town, he co-wrote The Bandwagon, he co-wrote Auntie Mame, and Singing in the Rain, which is yeah, like, wow.
Isn't that crazy? Like,
and what I love is that you look at this guy and you're like, he looks like what you imagine a showrunner to look like. You know what I mean? He kind of looks like Freddie DeCordova from The Tonight Show. He doesn't look like somebody who's, oh, here we go, speaking of actors, you've got Cameron Mitchell. The great Cameron Mitchell as Rojak, as this crooked this mobster guy, and his lawyer, who played by George Tyner, a guy who again you've seen in 10,000 things.
So
he was
many
generally
things, yeah.
Playing a shyster. He plays the lawyer for Chevy Chase's ex wife in Fletch, who hits Fletch up for his alimony payments. He's always kind of like a sniveling kind of guy. He was, you know, very, you know, not necessarily typecast, but you sort of always saw him in a similar role, and he had hundreds of credits, this guy. So here again, so Cameron Mitchell was probably the only other real genuine movie star we've got going here, and I love how big he plays this.
I mean, they get to do a great bit right here.
A bit with the cigars.
Yeah, so you basically have you have this Al Capone-ish character now visiting the television studios and suing, putting a lawsuit out for defamation for making fun of him. And you have this King Kaiser character, this Sid Caesar character, not taking it seriously at all. And he is just doing, he's just copying him. He's doing a mirror gag with him. And he's dressed like him. He's dressed in his gangster costume while this scene is happening. And it's just some physical comedy that's very funny.
One of the turns I love in this movie is that you would imagine if you wrote this movie or you know, wrote something like it, the path of least resistance for comedy would be to write King Kaiser as on stage, he's a tough guy, but you know, behind the scenes, when he meets an actual mobster, he folds, because that would be, you know, you could think that would be funny. But I like that Kaiser is a tough guy. He doesn't back down. I love that. I love that he's, even when he's threatened with physical violence from Rojak, he's basically tells Rojak to go pounce in. And in fact, there's this, we're going to do this runner of throwing things out windows. And I love that he grabs Rojak's hat and throws it out the window at a moment. I think it's very unusual for what you would, I think, expect for it to be, how it to play out.
Yeah, this turns into a, you know, man thing, like an ego thing, for lack of a better term, dick measuring contest.
Yep.
And he doesn't back down at all. He just goes full on, and he's the big man on set, except for Leo there. Leo is his, the only person that he'll really listen to at the end of the day.
Right. Leo even gets to smack him on the head at one point, and he tolerates that because, again, he is the producer. But I love this. What you're saying, and in this removal business, if something bothers you, like, I love it. Like, he's just looking for things. I love the sound effect of, we heard when Rojek threw the cardboard out the window. We hear the car screeching, and then there you go. He chucks the coat out the window, and then we're going to get honking. I'm
just wondering if those honking horns are like afterthoughts too. I mean, being a film producer, I always think about these things. I'm like, that seems like it could have totally been added in post just as an afterthought.
Yep.
And
yep.
It's really funny.
Yeah. I mean, it's the imagination is always so much better at, you know, for conjuring images, and it's great. You know, you don't get to see any of the mayhem being caused, the stuff being thrown out of 30 Rock and landing on the street. Fight is in rounds. I love that he grabs the wrong hat. He grabs.
He's found one.
Yeah, I love that he grabs. Yeah. Kaiser's hat, and it's comically way too big for him. That's great.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's just perfect.
Never at the Waldorf Tower. Here we go. I love this bit too, where they're like, "How is he walking?" And then the payoff to this.
Yeah, this is a great physical bit. Peter O'Toole is in between Marklin Baker and his this actor who's playing his like chauffeur, and he just like, it's so odd how he's walking, and the camera pans out, and you see that he's actually on the luggage cart being toted along, and Peter O'Toole is fantastic.
Oh, that's great. I just love the dead-eyed look he gives Benji while he's being escorted.
He's so funny while he's being hauled around. Oh, and he's doing the ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yep. They're pulling him up the stairs, yeah. This is a hell of a nice room in the Waldorf. It's like got two levels. It's pretty sweet.
He's a movie star.
He's a movie star.
To be fair, that is where I housed all of the actors when I did a movie in New York, is at the Waldorf Astoria.
What was that? Which movie was that?
That was Margin Call.
Wow.
I made a deal with them. They gave me cheap rooms for everybody as long as we did the press conference in the Waldorf Astoria.
Wow.
So this is a great gag that's about to come up where he's going to rip off the suit.
Oh yeah, the breakaway suit. This is great because they've been through this before. This is again a great prop comedy of the suit just tears away because he's often unconscious, and he has to deal with Alan this way. This is his long suffering assistant Alfie, played by Tony DiBenedetto, who has also similarly many credits. He was in movies like Marked for Death with Steven Seagal, unfortunately. Raw Deal, he was in Splash, he was in Analyze This. That's his last credit. Doesn't mention that whether he is still with us, but that was his last credit. And he was in a bunch of episodes of Cheers, playing a character simply called Tony. I can't for the life of me think of who that is, but he was in 9 episodes of Cheers.
Feel like now that you say that, that rings a bell, and it's just from like watching Cheers along with Ryan Daly's Cheers cast that I feel like he's in whatever some of the recent seasons that I've watched. So
I can't think of who Tony is, but he was in 9 shows.
Who hung out at the bar. Yeah.
Oh, I love that he's got the suitcase full of liquor.
It only has liquor in it.
It only has liquor in it and a tie or socks.
Socks.
The drinking socks.
Drinking socks.
And now we're going to, they're going to see this about his daughter, that he has Alan Swan has a daughter that he doesn't see. It's going to pay off later in
Connecticut, on the other side of New York.
Now, all right, Corey, I will ask you, obviously we're not going to get into specifics, but have you ever dealt with any actors that were this level of a pain?
Yes, I actually have. Okay. And watching the movie this time around, it actually, I watched this as a kid, as a fan of somebody who wanted to enter the industry. I don't think I'd really watched it again. Somebody who works in the industry now, and I like so relate to some of these characters, and I'm like, oh, I've been through this. I've been through it more than a few times.
Okay. Oh boy.
And with having to get people to just show up and try to keep somebody with somebody else, and anyway, it happens, and sometimes it's fine and whatever. It's part of the business.
I like his line about, how did I get here? He doesn't. He woke up in the Waldorf Astoria. Doesn't know how he got there because he was too pickled.
You know, but Swan has this thing about him where he says stuff like that, but then you find out that he's never really not listening.
Mm-hmm.
He's always listening, even when he appears to be passed out.
Right. He'll talk about later in the movie how he sort of kind of does what people expect of him to a certain extent, and his persona precedes him as this guy. And he's, so he kind of wants to live up to it or down to it a little bit.
The line that's like my favorite quote from this movie, and it's really kind of says it all, is he says, I'm not an actor. I'm a movie star. And I know people like that. And,
wow.
And they can be fabulous people, actually, just like Peter O'Toole is in mm-hmm. this. Sometimes the business treats people really hard sometimes. This is a representation of somebody who just is kind of going along for the ride as it happens. And he's stuck in this whirlwind, the way it's portrayed. You know, he's this supposed to be this charming man who in most cases you would look at as like a womanizing piece of crap. But with the way that Peter O'Toole plays it, it just kind of comes across as this like non-threatening. Like he's never actually like hitting on the women as much as they're hitting on him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he'll be in the next scene in the store club. He'll actually be quite charming. Yeah, the store club, the late great store club, which is again not a thing that exists anymore. But yeah, I can only imagine if you're like Mark Lynn Baker and you do a movie with Peter O'Toole, how do you not decide to spend most of your time not in your trailer and just sit and talk to him? I mean, good Lord, this is a guy who is in Lawrence of Arabia, for Pete's sakes. You know, how do you not just, I mean, I'm sure
Mark Lynn Baker was having a pretty awesome first movie, as far as I can tell. Yeah. Like,
maybe Peter O'Toole wanted to go back and lay down and he didn't want to be peppered with stories, but how do you not do that? How do you not just say, what was it like to be in, one of the great films ever made?
They're in basically every scene together.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that they had a pretty good relationship.
Yeah, this really is a two-hander with them. I mean, they really there really is virtually no scenes without them together. There's some scenes with Benji without Alan Swan, but most of the scenes with Alan Swan, he's with Benji.
It needs to be that way, you know. Represents that other it represents like the Benji. This is like the year that Benji is gonna like lose his innocence, basically, mm-hmm. and the year that his idols, you know, he took people off of the pedestals that he puts his childhood idols off of pedestals, and it's difficult, and it's a moment in life sometimes that you have to deal with. And for me, as somebody who works in the business, it's true. Sometimes meeting your heroes, it just is not the experience you could have possibly imagined. You project so much onto people. It's not fair. It's not fair to them.
Right.
And, you know, this movie and their relationship in it is a relationship of a kid who has projected every hero onto this actor. And he's used to that. He's just used to it.
Yeah, they're getting to know each other here. And again, the setup of the plot is that Alan is, you know, maybe not to be trusted to show up on a live TV show, and Benji makes the case for him because he loves Alan Swan so much. And so King Kaiser basically says, well, if you're going to vouch for him, you got to stick by him. You got to keep him on the up and up. And that's why he's spending all this time with him. He's sort of making sure that he doesn't get in too much trouble so he can be at this live show, which is going to be airing on Friday night or whatever it is. So
I would say they basically stole the plot of this for the film, Get Him to the Greek.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. It is kind of basically the same idea, isn't it? But yeah, here we go. Now this guy's going to come over and he says, would you mind meeting my wife? I love this scene. This is really sweet, where he is that you keep thinking that maybe he's going to ruin it or something, but he doesn't. He just is very, very sweet to this woman who's clearly, an older woman. By the way, recognize the older woman playing the woman who's about to
Miss Horn.
Yeah, Miss Horn. That is Gloria Stewart from Titanic and the Invisible Man.
Of course it is. Look at
yeah,
her.
Yeah. So there you go. This is a part of Rose's adventures that she had after Jack died. And that
she feels very Rose-like now that you said that. That's gonna I feel like she's having a dance with Jack.
Exactly. She's
projecting Jack right onto Peter O'Toole.
Exactly. But like I said, I love that they don't, I love that this doesn't go for a laugh, this scene. Like it's just, he's just charming.
The movie bounces back and forth sometimes tonally between being like very sincere and being very shticky. So sometimes it surprises you with really tender moments. This is one of them. But at the end of the day, this sweet and tender moment is he's just going to take it to his advantage to use to walk out of this place with somebody else's girl.
Yeah. He told Benji, I'm going to need a distraction in about 5 minutes while he does all this. Again, this is just great. This is really charming. He's really sweet. And she's obviously an old fan of his. And he gives her this moment. It's great. But it's all, the setup is he's going to try and abscond with this rough-looking guy's wife who's been giving him the eye. And here we go. Benji is dutifully doing this physical bit with the cakes about this. And so here we go. That Swan is making off with this woman who doesn't even get a line, but she gives Alan Swan the eye the whole time. This is the actress name is Amanda Horan Kennedy. She did a lot of TV credits. She Remington Steele, Heart to Heart, Quantum Leap, things like that. But she's obviously really interested in Alan Swan. And so he's going to make off with her. And then we see in the next, Alan Swan and Playmate Nude in Central Park.
Naked in the Bethesda Fountain.
Yeah, there you go.
We're on back at this TV studio next morning at 30 Rock. And, you know, everybody's just like, told you this was going to be a nightmare. Swan is already causing problems for all of us.
Every movie
is so funny in this movie.
Every movie I've ever seen that features a writing staff on a movie or a TV show, I always feel like the writing staff is way smaller than it really needs to be in real life. Because in the movie, they have to, they don't want to have 12 actors in the set. So the writing staff is always like four people. And, I just watched the Being the Ricardos. And if you watch that movie, you would think that I Love Lucy was written by three people. And it's like,
well, it actually might have been.
Oh, really? Okay.
In the day, it might have been. I can't speak for it. I'm learning more about it right now, actually, on a project I'm working on. And I'm like, it can be. The writer's room can be three people.
Wow.
But on a show like this, or on a show that I like had seen writer's rooms on TV before, on like the Dick Van Dyke Show, they're review shows, they would probably have actually a big team of writers on. This is like if SNL had three writers for all of SNL.
Yeah. You look at the writing staff on the SNL credits, there's like 20 names that go by. So yeah, it's like, oh Lord, they only have.
Yeah.
And Benji is kind of, they treat Benji like he's an intern, but he's not. He's actually a writer. He is but he seems to be kind of like an apprentice, or
he's a freshman writer. There are literally four of them: freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior. That is what it is.
Here you go. Finally, Leo's going to get frustrated with the there. Bang! nobody else can get away with hitting the star over the head with a newspaper unless you're the showrunner.
Yeah, no, Leo's the producer, and I have to say, this is the character that when I watch it now, I related most to his story arc throughout, dealing with all of this and trying to ignore as much of it as he can and deal with what he has to, and yeah.
Oh, I love that little physical gag. The guy on the phone, when he saw Kaiser coming, he purposely turned away from him, kind of pretended like he wasn't there because he didn't want Kaiser to talk to him.
I didn't even notice that. That's funny.
That's a great bit. By the way, Bill Macy in this movie, I feel like Bill Macy, Richard Benjamin's direction was like 11. Do it at 11, Bill, because he's like yelling through the whole movie.
I think he's really funny. because he's so always so angry, and then as soon as King walks into the room, he has to take it down a notch.
Yep.
So here is the introduction of an amazing character played by the fabulous Lainey Kazan.
Right.
So she plays Benji's mother, who is like the stereotypical Jewish mom. She's in Brooklyn, and you know, she wants to know how her baby's doing. She's really proud of him.
And we find out that his name is Steinberg, not Stone. He changed it, which was pretty standard at the time. And she's kind of, getting on his case a little bit.
When am I going to see Benji Steinberg on the screen? Yeah. Who is this Benji Stone?
Yep. Now, comic book fans will probably be most familiar with Lainey Kazan, as she was the visual inspiration for Big Barda by Jack Kirby. When Jack Kirby created that character for the New Gods, he based it off Lainey Kazan.
I feel like I remember hearing that on one of your podcasts before, and that's the first time I heard that. I knew her from so many things. I don't have her IMDb page in front of me right now, but
she was in My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Right.
She made appearances in shows like Ugly Betty, Desperate Housewives. She did a lot of movies in the 80s and stuff. And she was in a movie that I saw a movie on her IMDb page called Tango Shalom, which is a comedy, which also features Joseph Bologna. So they were both in that movie together. So here we go. That's a reunion for the two of them here.
Well, and I'll bring it up at this point just because we're talking about her, but Lainey Kazan is the only person from this cast to reprise her role when they redid this as a musical in the 1990s, starring Tim Curry in the Alan Swan role. But Lainey Kazan reprised her role as the mom and sang a bunch of songs, and she steals the show pretty much. So,
well, that's the perfect segue, because I wanted to ask you about that, because talk about that. You were involved with the musical version of My Favorite Year.
I love My Favorite Year. When I was in high school, I became aware of a musical of it. It was this little tiny musical that was happening on Broadway that didn't really have a long run. And me and the other kids in my high school became obsessed with this show to the point that we bullied the high school drama teacher into letting us do it our senior year as the high school musical. And I definitely played King Kaiser, and I had so much fun doing this. It was like one of the big highlights of when I was acting when I was a kid. I had so much fun doing this. Rob knows this because I sent Rob a hard to find clip of me in a sketch from this that was on YouTube. And what did you think, Rob? Did you like my performance?
It I did enjoy it. I mean, it's amazing to see you doing these things and singing and dancing. Of course, you know, this film is not a musical, so then they converted it into a musical. But I mean, it's amazing. It's just amazing to see you doing this. I mean, how comfortable were you singing in front of people? I mean, you were trained to be an actor, so obviously it's all sort of par for the course, but still.
I was in a performing arts high school. I went to performing arts college, and that's all what I did. I loved this, and I loved this. I loved this show. I loved My Favorite Year, the musical. I loved this movie.
Here's he's talking to Selma Diamond again. This even a dirty joke he gets away with. Oh man, cut to the hot dogs. Okay,
yeah, there's a lot of dick jokes in this movie. I'm just gonna say it. Watching it with the modern eye, it's very much written through a male's like fantasy gaze of things.
Yes,
where like Benji Stone, he's supposed to be cute and charming, but he's also like harassing
Jessica Harper's character.
Character, like really in a really aggressive way, mm-hmm. until he bullies her into like going out with him. I mean, he like chases her into a bathroom.
Yep.
Like it's it's shown as charming through the lens of all of this, like, you know, thrown through the, you just gotta keep pursuing the girl if you want her to be a girl.
he's Peter Venkman-ing it big time.
Big time.
Now, okay, I want to ask you as a movie producer, I'm sort of fascinated because there's the scene of the two of them here. They're walking down the street and he's being talked to. This woman is asking for an autograph and he's giving her the eye. And we see all this period detail. We see all the vintage posters for plays and all these old marquees and these cars. Like, is that, in your estimation, is that mostly going to be backlot or is that location? Because I would imagine if it's location, you've got to reface all those buildings that so they look like it's 1954.
Some of this is definitely backlots. I think some of it's easier to tell. And some of it, yeah, some of it's just location and you just have to get some of those exteriors and then you just redress New York. You know, try to make it look like it used to look. I just saw West Side Story and whatever Steven Spielberg did to make New York look like what he did in that movie is incredible.
Yeah. Now, I imagine you're right. If you're Steven Spielberg, of course, you've got unlimited money.
Of course.
To do whatever you want. But I'm like, okay, to get vintage cars, like, is it like a company that you go that does this, that just owns these cars and rents them out for things? Is that how it works?
It is, actually. Usually you can find, there are different places that's, you just go to certain places for those kinds of props and, you know, that's part of like the prop department. So when you hire a prop master onto your show, they're going to come with their book of, you know, places that they know to go to get all sorts of different things, whether it's period or modern.
Gotcha. Okay. I've always wondered about that because it's like, I mean, there's got to be some local company that owns a fleet of, you know, 1950s cars, 1940s cars, and they just
keep renting them out. Yeah, there's probably like lots of cars that appear in the same movies over and over and over again. Like I can tell you for a fact, there's like one subway car that they rent out over and over again that you can use in New York to like shoot all the subway scenes that you see in every movie that you've ever seen with the subways. Like, same thing with shooting inside of airplanes or fuselages. It's like, there's only a handful of fuselages that you can shoot in, and they just dress the interior to look like whatever airline they want, even if you're doing airline commercials, because, you know.
What's it like shooting a movie in New York? I mean, we talked about that over on Fade Out, where we talked about Never Here, with directed by Camille Tamin and starring Muriel Enos and Sam Shepard. I mean, what's it like shooting in New York? It seems like it would be a huge logistical nightmare versus doing it in Los Angeles, which is more of a film town.
Well, it's a little easier to be inconspicuous in LA, you would think, but it's not really because there are so many people there. And in New York, it's, I don't know, I've shot three times in New York, and while there are certain things that make it like really challenging to shoot in New York, it's also, there's things that make everything better.
Okay.
It's easy for like everybody to get what they want when you're in New York, to get whatever you want to eat, to kind of do whatever you want to do. If you need something, it's going to take 5 minutes to go run and get it, like for the shoot. There's those aspects that make it easy. The logistics, though, of clearing everything in New York when you have an exterior shoot, I mean, it makes days really large. It makes you need a lot of people for certain days because you have to block off entire blocks. You have to do everything legit. If you try and steal shots in New York, you'll get stopped. I've tried to do it before. Like, you will get stopped. So you need to have a bunch of proper paperwork in place to make that happen. Most of this film is shot interiors. They have a few establishing shots that they needed. Some of the stuff you can clearly tell, like when we're going to get to Brooklyn and some rooftop stuff, that it's like, see, there's like bad green screening going on at one point.
That's a lot of Chinese food they got, by the way. Look at that. Look how many cards they got of food. That's a lot.
Well, it's where he has his great line where he says something like, my mother you know, said there were two things about Jews, like we know suffering and where to find great Chinese food.
Now, this is, I'll give Benji credit. This is a fairly, I think, fairly charming date, and that he's taken her to dinner and a movie, but it's all in the offices of the show, and that they got Chinese food, and now they're running one of Alan Swan's movies on a reel. Now, he's being obnoxious by quoting it along, and she's telling him repeatedly, stop doing this, and he's not, which he's not fully understanding.
Here's the thing that doesn't work to me about this is, like, he's not charming. You know, she's acting like she has won over by all this and charmed, but he's not charming, and he mansplains a lot to her that scene when they're eating Chinese food. And now that they just all of a sudden decide to kiss, and you see how she's like looking at him like she's mm-hmm. like, oh, wow, you're so special and different. And I'm like, but that's like going against what you were just saying and how you were just
Jessica Harper's having to do a lot of work here to kind of sell this. You mentioned this was written by men, and it definitely does have that perspective. By the
male gaze to it. It's hard to not see these things these days now when you're going back and looking at things through a more modern lens, and you're like, oh, Jesus.
It was written by two guys, Norman Steinberg and Dennis Palumbo. This was Dennis Palumbo's last credit. But Norman Steinberg is also credited for the screenplay of Blazing Saddles, among other things. And so obviously, because this was produced by Mel Brooks, he had worked with Mel Brooks, so they had a history together. And this is credited to the two of them. Again, look at all this. This is beautiful, this whole sequence in the movie. I mean, this looks genuine.
This is a nice shot when this is gonna, you know, we're getting a shot of the movie screen of these characters kissing as it pans out and we see Benji and Casey kissing each other. It's just that he didn't earn this kiss. He's getting kissed right now that he really didn't earn. And she's working hard. Like, she looks like she's enjoying that. Like, I'm just like, he didn't make you fall in love in that moment. Come on. But that's how she's playing it.
Yeah.
She's like all of a sudden deeply in love. So it doesn't come across creepy.
Here we go. Now we're at 30 Rock and they're rehearsing the Three Musketeers sketch. And Peter O'Toole, again, they're singing big, doing it big. You could see why someone would think this could turn into a musical. You could see it. You could see, like, oh, yeah, there's a lot of performances, and you could see, you know, why someone would think we can add some music to this.
I love the musical of this. I might force you to listen to the whole thing at some point, but it's, I think it's a great representation of it. They didn't have time to fit in the gangster subplot. There was just no space for that in the musical. But pretty much everything else makes it.
Well, in the musical, there's a Musketeer sketch. Which in the movie we never see. They reference it, and they were going to do it, but they never actually do it. But in the musical, that's like a big part of the musical.
It is. There are a bunch of weird things I noticed when I was watching this now, where just kind of happens a little differently in the two venues. But I mean, you know, they had to change the story to make it work. And to be specific to being a stage show. I never saw it. I would have loved to have. I think Tim Curry would have been just amazing in this role in his own way.
You could see Tim Curry in this. You could totally see Tim Curry in that kind of part. He's big and charming, you know? I don't want to say he's Peter O'Toole-like, but he's not.
He might be a little more threatening than Peter O'Toole's very, like, he's very non-threatening. He's... which makes the character just great and likable. Tim Curry is likable and I never saw it with him, but I've heard his performance on the soundtrack a dozen times. Very devious sounding. So here we have a light just fell from the studio in 30 Rock and almost hit King Kaiser on the head. And he's assuring everybody he's okay. This is foreshadowing to us that
the mob's out to get him. Now, this is, I mean, I don't know whether they took this is just their own creation or literally took it from reality. But I remember I heard a similar story about there was a child actress in Meet Me in St. Louis, and she was up for the part, and the cameraman, like some lighting guy's daughter, was up for the part, and the lighting guy's daughter didn't get it, and then the actress that did get it almost got crushed by a falling light the next day or something, and they had to fire the guy because they were like, you just tried to kill our leading actress.
Oh, that's so interesting. that is, like, you know, loosely based on that. Yeah. This thing is such an loosely based everything. Benji and Swan have now left 30 Rock, and they're going to Brooklyn, where Benji is going to reluctantly bring Alan Swan to his parents' apartment for dinner, where Alan Swan will have his first experience in Brooklyn.
Now, there's Lou Jacoby as his uncle, and Lou Jacoby, if you don't know the name, you know the voice, you know the face. He, again, another one of these guys who has it's funny. I'm looking at his IMDb profile, and it only has 74 credits. That's not a lot.
Only 74.
But I mean, there are other people that have hundreds. I would have expected more. But this is a guy you just saw in a million things. He was in Amazon Women on the Moon, which is kind of a guilty pleasure of mine. He's also in Arthur. Yeah. I mean, he was on TV. He did tons of stuff. This kind of, you know, roly-poly guy. Anytime you needed, like, an embarrassing uncle, he was your guy. You know, that's the guy you got. So, I mean, it's perfect casting for that kind of role here. And he's meeting father-in-law, the boxer.
Roca Carioca,
yes. And everyone's trying to act like this is normal and everything's fine. But of course, they're having a giant movie star in their house. This is a kind of a big deal.
Yeah, no, this whole scene, I swear to God, I've lived through this. I've been Benji in this scene. This is my mom. This is how my mom has acted when I had this experience happen with my mom and Robert Redford, essentially.
Oh my God. Wow.
I was basically him in this scenario. My mom was fawning all over Robert Redford, and I was like, Mom, stop. Mom, he's not, you know, it's like, don't call him Bobby, Mom. He's Robert Redford.
Mr. Redford, please call him Mr. Yeah. Redford. Wow.
So, yeah, no, this is actually all very, like, real to me, and I don't know, this family kind of reminds me of, like, you know, part of my family that I had growing up. He's just so inappropriate, Uncle Morty. Like,
I love he asked for the autograph, and he's got a stack. He's got like six things to autograph. Yeah.
And I would be like, Morty, what are you doing, Morty? Don't do that. And that would be my house. Yeah, for sure.
And Swan's being, he could not be nicer.
Yes.
He could not be, you know, he's signing everything dutifully. He's like, it's all fine. It's, you know, he's. I mean, it's even nice of him to go to this. I could see why Alan Swan would be sort of like, why am I
he's completely defeated, and he doesn't even ask for alcohol here. You know, he is a drunk this whole thing, and he's trying to be good. So this is the best. His aunt walks into the apartment now.
In a wedding dress for some
reason. In a wedding dress. And she's like, do you like it? I only wore it once.
Now, this actress is named Annette Robbins. She has 3 credits. That's it. This movie, 1 episode of In Living Color, and then a short, and that is it. And I'm always amazed at, like, where do these actors come from that manage to appear in a giant movie like this and have nothing else? Like, how do they get the gig? With no, I mean, are they theater actors that happen to know somebody? Because it
right
just seems
place,
so
at the right time.
Yeah,
I mean, it really is that. You know, I know when sometimes you really, like, in a scene like this where we have a nice big ensemble scene, everybody sitting at a dinner table, all these different faces, So we want these people, some of these people, to just be really interesting looking. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not necessarily even about like how talented an actor. It's like you want kind of real people in these moments. And like, this could have just been like the right person that they needed for this scene on this day that they found somewhere. I have definitely pulled people into scenes and movies off of the street while we're shooting things.
Wow.
And just been like, do you want to be in this right now? And then they get really mad because you won't let them leave then. Because you're like, can you do it again? I need you to stay and do it again and again and again.
The actor playing Benji's stepdad, the boxer, is Ramon Sison. He only has, again, a handful of credits. He passed away in 2009. I love his credit as in Troop Beverly Hills with Shelley Long. He plays Bong Bong the Dictator. Oh, so boy. Whatever.
This poor guy. This role doesn't, you know, this role stands slightly, can feel slightly racist. He's like a Filipino character that she's married. And the way, you know, in the musical, it's much more of a love story about the two of them. And she's got a big song about how much that this man means to her after her first husband, Benji's father, you know, passed away or left. And in this, he just kind of feels like her manservant that mm-hmm. she has doing the dishes. And he's like, you know, and they call him like China. They call him bad names. I won't say them, actually. There's some slurs in this.
There was a little bit of a Long Duk Dong kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of persona to this a little bit. But she does love him. I mean, you know what I mean? They don't.
Yes, that's the idea that you should be taking, is that it's not a joke, though. Like, that's, I think, what's hard. It's like a hard line. And it's like he's not the joke.
Yeah.
That's not the joke, that he is this guy. That's real love, so.
Right, because Belle here is extolling the virtues of having a family. And then he reveals that he's got a daughter. And then Belle is sort of like, he says, I haven't seen her in over a year. Alan says, I haven't seen her in over a year.
Shame on you.
Shame on you, Swanee.
Shame on you, Swanee.
Yeah.
She calls him Swanee. And he's like, Ma, Swanee is a river. That's something my mom would totally do. If, like, with the celebrity sitting at the dinner table and being like, what you need is a family. You're not really happy, are you?
Well, here's the button on the scene, is that they're going to leave. And then he's going to come out of the hallway. Oh, she gives him a kiss on the lips. Wow.
A kiss on the lips.
And then boom, here, we've got the whole hallway full of people.
All of Brooklyn has shown up in front of the apartment building now, and they're all telling him what apartments they live in.
4B.
He walks by. As if that means something to him. I think it's really funny. They're like, yeah, I'm Scaloni in 1R.
The guy immediately talking to him, another character actor named Stanley Brock. Again, you don't know the name, but you know the face. This is a guy literally with hundreds of credits. He was on Night Court. He was in UHF with Weird Al Yankovic, Simon and Simon. He's the mayor, Days of Our Lives, the A-Team. Again, he always kind of played like a hard ass. Tend to play like landlords and things like that. So look at this crowd. Look at this crowd that they've assembled.
They all showed up. This is basically would be like if, you know, this would be like right now if Kim Kardashian or something showed up on the block. But that's the modern.
Yes.
Sorry, Rob. That is modern. Like,
but sadly, yes, that is accurate. So here we go. Now
he's got his emergency. They've escaped Brooklyn. Now they're in his private car driving away. He's got his private stash of liquor, and he's going for it.
This very much is Errol Flynn, because Errol Flynn essentially drank himself to death.
Peter O'Toole almost drank himself to death. I think it was like around this time that they told him he had liver cancer, but then he was falsely diagnosed with liver cancer.
Wow.
But I believe he stopped drinking when he was told he had liver cancer.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
Maybe not. I don't know. I never met Peter O'Toole.
He continued to star in movies through the 80s. I mean, he was a headliner in other movies. He was in Supergirl, which is unfortunate.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, he's in that movie. And he was in a movie with Mariel Hemingway called Creator.
Look, these are where there's some sketchy green screen, I think, going on.
Oh, here we go.
I feel like this is the same rooftop that they shot in the movie The Room.
There we go. We could see the right at that line of where the balcony is where the footage is. But here we go. This is Alan's going to get this idea. He wants to get down to this party.
Well, he's a swashbuckler, and now they're on the roof of this building, and they're trying to figure out how to get to the apartment below them, to where this party is happening, that Casey Downing is supposed to be at.
Right.
But now they're locked on the roof, people. The door is locked.
I love his slightly wobbly legs.
He's like, we need a rope or something. His physicality in this is really just on fire. Yeah. What he does.
He's trying to reach up to. Here we go. Now he's going to get the idea of using the
fire hose,
which of course was stolen later on for Die Hard. So, you know, come on, you bunch of hacks. You stole that from my favorite year. So, and I also got, I love that the ring of the fire hose looks like a film can.
It totally does.
It looks like a film reel.
He's so excited about the fire hose. I think his performance is so stunning. So, yeah, he's just wrapping this fire hose around him, and Benji's trying to stop him.
Has any door that our character has gone through to get to the roof ever not locked after they've shut it behind them? Has that ever happened in the history of movies? I feel like every time.
I'm going to sound like such a douche, but like in one of my movies, we had them.
There you go. Yeah.
They didn't get locked out on the roof. So like they made it out. Okay. In the film Margin Call, we shot on the roof in Manhattan of a scene. It was actually one of the most dangerous shots I've ever done because it's really windy on the roof of a tall Manhattan building and scary.
Wow. Oh, this is here. This is sort of terrifying.
So he's on standing on this side of the roof. You're like, don't jump, Alan, don't jump. It's too dangerous.
Not when you've been instructed by Niblick.
Who is Niblick?
Who the hell is Niblick? My Sherpa guide from the Himalayas.
Which I swear to God, these are like conversations I've had with people, stuff like this. So he's trying to get him off the roof, and he accidentally.
There you go. Great. Oh. And then now, of course, yeah, I think at the speed that was going, it would probably rip Alan Swan in half because he was so thin already. But okay. You know, that's the way it works in these movies.
So you just have these weird two guys standing there drinking cocktails, being very nonchalant about the fact that Alan Swan just dropped past them and being like, you know that actor from that movie?
That is loosely tied. That is not, he is not well secured there.
That is
Defender of the Crown. This looks like the church that the Batman dangled off of at the end of Batman. Jack Nicholson's going to show up and start kicking the gargoyle off in a second. Now, let me ask you as a movie producer, like all these sets, right? These are all built in a studio, obviously. Do the stuff like this ever get reused? Or is it
of it's a set, some of it are actual locations. I mean, these are sets for sure. Like that's a set.
Right, sure. But like does this get put into storage in case they have another movie that needs this? It seems such a
wasteful totally.
To build it and destroy it, you know.
No, I guarantee you these sets have been used in other films before. And yeah, we'll repaint things, recycle them, reuse them, repurpose. Okay. Right. For sure.
That makes me feel better because it's, you know, good Lord, you built these things and this, you know, it seems such a waste.
I know I've done it before and then it was like years have gone by and I'm like, how long are we going to pay for the storage to keep holding these sets? Like,
is that really, that's what it is? You go, you put them in a storage facility somewhere and you're just paying the rent.
What we did on our first movie, on Margin Call. I remember it was like a big pain in my butt. I eventually had to go there and personally pull everything out of storage. And I started, I sent some of it back to LA. I gave some of it away. I kept all of the clothes from the movie, all of the actors' outfits. And then I just started wearing them because I was like, these are some nice suits. So Benji and Swan have now left this building that they were trying to break into, unsuccessfully not finding Casey Downing. And now they are walking in Central Park.
Now, this is probably, now I would imagine shooting in Central Park is probably prohibitively expensive, although it, you see it in movies a lot. But this is kind of works in story, and then I'm imagining shooting it probably dawn is a lot cheaper because nobody's there. But that also fits for the plot because they've been up all night. So
look,
it makes
at the
sense
lighting
that it would
in
be
this shot. I mean, it's great. This is the magic hour. So, yeah.
Well, here's Alan is revealing that his real name is Clarence Duffy. And he comes from sort of a humble background. And he gets plucked at the 18. He joins the Navy, jumps ship at Liverpool. This all feels like Peter O'Toole. You know, this feels like all of this could have been Peter O'Toole. I would just finish reading a book about the legendary producer Sam Spiegel, who produced Lawrence of Arabia. And the only reason that Lawrence of Arabia did not star Albert Finney was because Sam Spiegel, when he hired actors, he locked them into 5-picture contracts. And Albert Finney was a name at that point, and he did not want to be locked into a 5-picture deal. He didn't want to work for – he did not want to be locked down like that. So he turned it down, and they went to their next choice, which was Peter O'Toole, who was not a name at that point. And that's what – you know, imagine that, though. Imagine – I mean, I love Albert Finney.
So many great movies have been made because so many great actors have said no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's true. You rarely get the person that you want to star in your movies. You usually do end up with a second, third, fourth, fifth, or sixth choice.
I'm going to assume Robert Redford was your first choice in that.
That is the only movie that I've ever done where he was the first choice. He was the only person that we ever talked to about being in the movie as the actor, and that was that.
And in case people don't know, what movie are you talking about?
All Is Lost.
All is Lost. A great movie. If anyone has not seen All Is Lost, go see it. It is a terrific, terrific movie. And I'm not saying that because I am friends with Corey. I saw it long before Corey and I knew each other, and I thought it was terrific. And I told everybody, after I saw it, I told everybody who would listen, go see this movie. This is a terrific movie. And it really
it was definitely my job to like pull that raft out of storage one day.
Wow.
And ship it somewhere else. And it's definitely when I grabbed Robert Redford's jacket, or not jacket, whatever, the rain jacket that I
the rain slicker
showed you picture.
Yeah. Yep.
I get to wear.
So now
Peter O'Toole has like stolen a police horse in Central Park and is just having an adventure. And they have this slow-mo shot of him riding the horse. He's really riding the horse.
Yeah, that was really them. And then this is probably stunt guys, right? Right there. But when the horse
definitely,
the horse bucks like that. But that other shot, that was clearly them.
That was him on the horse. So now, like, this scene right here, this isn't a real hotel. Like, this isn't a set.
Right.
I can tell this is, like, an actual hotel room.
Now, what? Why? How can you tell?
Because we panned from the window down.
Okay.
And now look at the dimensions and how there's barely any space, like, from left to right. This is, like, one of the suites at the Plaza. So, like, this, or not the Plaza, the Waldorf. The
Waldorf, yeah. I love the Art Deco door frame. Look at that. That's gorgeous. Those weird sconces there.
See, they can't pull the camera out anymore. Like, the wall is right behind them. This is like a real,
I love this. I love that he writes, "Dear Steinberg, going to see Tess, love Duffy." I love that he addresses it to Steinberg, not Stone, and then he signs it Duffy.
Well, which is also another indication of, you think that he is so plastered, how could he possibly remember any of these conversations he's having? But he does.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
He remembers that he revealed all that about himself last night.
Now, you just talked about how small this room is. Again, explain to people who don't know this. Like, most movie sets, right, are built like, what, 1.5 up? from real life? Is that how, is that the proportions are bigger than that?
No, man. I haven't shot on many movie sets.
Oh, really? You mostly? Okay.
Almost from what I've always heard, location that you dress, set dress. This is like a real location, like coming down that staircase. I mean, that's, yeah, you can tell, no, wait, this might actually be a set now. We don't want to do this right now in this movie. Okay. But like, you need space to be able to get, you know, movement into your shot. So if you're getting a dolly shot and you're pulling out, if there's a wall behind you, you can't do it. So if you can remove one of those walls, you can get much cooler shots.
Right. And but they can't because it's a real room.
Right.
It's real. The actress here playing the daughter, playing Tess, who does not actually have a line, but we see her here. This is a woman named Katie McLean, who is still working. She is mostly a soap opera actress. She's got credits on Days of Our Lives, Young and the Restless, something called Susie Effing Homemaker. I don't know what that is.
I've heard of that. How
have
cool.
You really? Okay. Yeah. She's Susie.
Our age.
Yeah, she's Susie. All My Children, As the World Turns, Law and Order. She was on Cheers as well. She was on St. Elsewhere. So, oh, wow. You know,
she's had a full long career for somebody who's like 8 in this movie.
Yeah. She did before this, Pennies from Heaven with Steve Martin. She's a dancer in that movie.
Pennies from Heaven, Bernadette Peters at her finest.
Another musical. Man, you love your musicals.
I you know, musicals and Star Trek. What could I say?
There you go. Do you have a favorite musical? Do you have a favorite one of all time? In terms of either a film or a play?
I mean, I love Stephen Sondheim. I was really sad about him passing away recently. It's hard to pick a favorite. There's so many good musicals. I've always been particularly obsessed with Company, the musical Company. And as odd as it might sound, I've always been a particularly big fan of Jesus Christ Superstar.
Okay.
I think I love the movie. I didn't understand it when I was a kid and I watched it. And as an adult, I think it's the coolest thing. Because it's such guerrilla style filmmaking that they're doing in the middle of Israel. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie.
I have not. I've never seen Jesus Christ.
We'll cover that for Easter, maybe.
Fair enough. I love this whole bit with King Kaiser with the no tongue. He can't serve tongue because that means the comedy won't be funny. I love that he's
got rituals. Yeah, yeah. He's got superstitions that he needs to make sure things don't happen. So we basically have found out now, you know, the staff is finding out that they think that Swan is gone and he's not going to be showing up, but he's actually in his dressing room right now. And he's made it back from Connecticut and is ready to go. But he is a broken man right now. Because, you know, it was hard for him to see his daughter that he just ran off on.
Very strange wood paneling in Leo's office. That seemed like the kind of paneling.
I don't feel like that would have been the thing in the 1950s.
No, it looks like a rec room. It doesn't look like the office of a TV show producer.
This is a good example. This might have just been like a location that they just needed to fake another part of another set. Like, you know, all these shots, like they're in a real building because you can see when they're looking out the window.
Mm-hmm.
They could redress the same office over and over again if they wanted to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I shot an entire movie. Margin Call was shot entirely on an office building floor. And anyway.
Wow.
It can be very cinematic because New York can be very cinematic out the windows, which this movie captures quite a bit of.
Yeah. Now I've read some stuff from Mel Brooks. I'm actually reading his biography right now, where he talks about working with Sid Caesar because he was at one point over the course of several different Sid Caesar comedy shows. He didn't just have the one; he had a couple. He had a writing staff that included Mel Brooks, Larry Gelbart, Neil Simon, and Woody Allen. I mean, they weren't the only writers, but I mean, good Lord, that is a murderer's row of talent to have
they
writing.
They probably all met at Shabbat, like Friday night Shabbat.
Uh,
Seriously.
I mean, can you imagine that? I can't, you know, that's
just, New York Jews stick together. Trust me.
Unreal.
I know this to be true.
But Marx since Caesar, right. According to Mel Brooks, though, Sid Caesar was very, as I mentioned, very physical, but also scary. Like he could get into real right. fits of temper. There's a legendary story where he got into an argument with somebody and somebody insulted him. And he literally tried to pull the driver through that little triangle window that old cars used to have. He literally tried to pull his face through it. And there was another one where apparently he dangled someone out of a building, out of the 30 Rock building, out of the skyscraper, literally dangled the guy by his feet, which is, just sounds completely terrifying.
Well, that's our King Kaiser here. He doesn't take any crap from anyone.
He's a little nicer. He's a little nicer to the state. I mean, he's a blowhard, and then he gets mad, and then he does all the bit about the
buy him some tires.
On here now, there's a wreath that they've left for him. You asked for it, and it's in black. So they're, none too subtly.
And his reaction to that is not to get crazy scared. He touches it, and then he's all confident now. Bring it on.
It's great. It's a really fun persona that you would not. You can't write comedy in California. It's not depressing enough.
So this is the great moment, the third act twist.
Yeah.
It's going to take Alan. Alan Swan is about to find out that this is actually going to be done in front of a live audience, and that is going to go to live television. And he's like, "What?
What are you talking about? Live? Yeah. Now, on one hand, you would think that's unrealistic. How could he not know? But I have read.
In 54, I can totally believe that.
Oh, I mean, I've read numerous books about Saturday Night Live where they have talked about that once in a while, one of the hosts would say, "All right, when do we tape?" And they would say, "The name of the show is Saturday Night Live. What are you talking about?" They're like, "We do it live Saturday night." Well, it's totally plausible. Now, maybe in the 50s that was less because everything was live back then. For the most part, they didn't tape things. They couldn't rebroadcast it, but still, it's the 70s. Still, you would think.
I played the butler. He's like, I
had one line
in 28 years where I played the butler and had one line.
Here's his line: "I'm not an actor, I'm a movie star." There you go.
Ah, beautiful line, beautiful piece of writing.
He's gonna take the wig off. There we go. I love this reaction. I love the "Oh holy mother" when he sees that pretty girl on the couch. That's a great. That feels like an ad lib. It probably wasn't.
And then look at her. She gets kicked out. It's like she was waiting there for him, and he's so upset he doesn't even want the young cigarette woman who had been inside of a cigarette box.
I love that take of "Oh holy mother," where he just sees her and he's like, "Wow." Of all these random people in different outfits. Do you have to clear all this stuff, the NBC stuff? I guess you do, right? Because it's a real thing. You can't. Because they're just not a made up network. They're saying this is airing on NBC.
They would have to clear everything. Okay. For sure. All right. The clearance report that you have to run before you can, officially have your movie air or sell.
Right. Now, I'm guessing nowadays it's got to be a lot easier because everyone knows that movies live on in other media. But, this is 82. This is probably near the end of that era where...
Let me tell you, in today's day and age, they would not have gotten that Nat King Cole song at the opening of this movie.
Oh, really? Why is that?
They just wouldn't be able to afford it now.
Oh, really? Wow.
I'm sure of it. Yeah. Okay.
But I mean, 82, video cassettes were a thing, but in the beginning, it was kind of in its infancy.
Barely. Yeah, it cost $100.
Yeah, right. Yeah, $79.99 and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I imagine that this is near the end of when movies were made, they didn't necessarily write into the contracts the rights for it to live forever, because there were some movies from around this time that you cannot get anymore. You can't get at all in any home video format because of the rights issues. And there's some of my favorite movies that are completely unavailable because of that reason. But nowadays, of course, everyone knows.
Perpetuity. You need to have everything in perpetuity. That's the legal language.
Yeah.
Swan is walking out of the 30 Rock. He's like, forget this, looking for his chauffeur. So drunk, he can't even find the right guy. And this is like a great moment when Benji's trying to get him to come back in and he finally finds his car. And though that's still not his car.
I love he thinks every chauffeur is his chauffeur. That's a great.
Just assumes.
Yeah.
And this is when Benji's just finally says, like, you're a disgusting person, you know? You end up making everyone who cares about you unhappy. And it's here when his assistant chauffeur basically throws the car keys at him.
Yeah. Alfie, take this bum to the Waldorf there. And then
Alfie's disappointed in him too. And Alfie's like been just blindly supporting anything that he wants. But not this time.
Yep.
Not this time. You drive yourself.
I love that King Kaiser knows all the girls too. I love that. He loves all the dancers. Nancy, you have a good show. He knows them all.
Of course he does.
Yeah.
And he hired each one of them personally. So now the gangsters have broken in to the studio and it got some Three Stooges fighting coming along. And now there's just a lot of fisticuffs that are going to happen the rest of the movie. This is all actually very noises off now, because we have the show happening on the stage, and then there's a show happening behind the scenes where King is getting beat up, and on stage, like, the cigarette girls are there in the legs inside of the cigarette boxes, which is amazing. Comedy Cavalcade, starring King Kaiser with his special guest star, Alan Swan. The audience is very enthusiastic about that.
I will tell you, the first time I ever went to a TV show taping for David Letterman, it was pretty amazing. You know, it really was to be able to see.
You must have had the guy who came in and warmed you all up before.
Yeah. It was. I ended up going to Letterman half a dozen times, and it was always thrilling to just be in 30 Rock and just seeing how TV was made, and again, how small the studio was. It's amazing how much the camera distorts the studio. When they would do these camera sweeps of the studio in Letterman, it looked like it was
it's
an auditorium.
Weird,
and you get in there and there was like about 50 seats. You're like, wow, this is it? This
show? Was the first time I ever went to one of those was in New York. I went to like an audience taping of The Daily Show in the early 2000s, and I was so confused. I thought it was going to be so much larger than
they were sitting on. I went to one of those too, and you were sitting on bleachers, you know? Bleachers. Yeah, it was not.
So here's Benji and Alan Swan's big dramatic scene where Mark Lynn Baker is really acting his little heart out to Peter O'Toole. And he's telling Swan, you're my hero, okay? Like, you might think that you're a normal guy, but you're not. You're special. You're special to me.
Now, he puts across this idea that there must be something of you in there that is that special, because you wouldn't be able to put it across if that was the case. Now, I mean, do you buy that, or do you think there are some people that are just that good of an actor?
No, I don't buy that. Like,
okay. Okay.
No, that was one thing I kind of disagreed with.
Right. Okay. Well, this is a very romanticized portrait of Hollywood and hero worship. So. But it's sweet, you know. It's the fight has spilled onto the set. They're trying to do this comedy sketch, bringing the car. I love the detail that we saw the car behind the scenes, and it's only half a car.
Yeah.
I thought that was a great detail. That of course they don't bring a whole car into it when you just need the front for the prop here. And now we're gonna get his gun mall. Obviously, they're all
waiting for King to make his appearance. They're calling for him. He's not coming. They're like, "What's going on?" And we know that King is fighting backstage right now. So first his like lady counterpart comes in without him. She's just burst through. And now we're like, what's going to happen?
There we go.
Smash through the set. And now all hijinks happens. And the audience loves it because they think it's all staged. But it's not. And King Kaiser is actually getting his butt kicked in front of a live audience. And there's only one person who could save him now.
This is such a this fight reminds me of so many episodes of Batman. You know, I mean, it doesn't have it doesn't have Pow and Biff, but it could. It's so totally silly and so big. Now we've got the guy. The guy wanders into the delivery man, and he just starts punching people for kind of no good reason, really.
With rhythm to it, yeah.
Yeah.
And the audience loves it. Yeah, I mean, you got to take this all with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
The gangsters turn into very much performers in this moment. They're not real people. Yeah.
This is also a thing that happens in movies where there's a television show is being made within the reality of the movie, where something always goes completely awry, and the director always says, let's go with it. That always happens. I would imagine in real life they would cut. Even if it was live, they would say, well, go to commercial. But I can think of like a couple different movies where they just said like Tootsie or Soap Dish, where something goes completely awry and the director
keep goes, rolling. This is solid gold.
Yeah, let's see where this is going. You know, that's kind of gutsy. Here we go. Porthole.
So Swan is now making his entrance from the balcony of the theater and swinging onto the stage brilliantly.
Boom! Knocks them all over like bowling pins.
And the audience is roaring with applause.
I think how many guys in the audience are in uniform. A lot of service members at this taping.
1954, you would have had a lot of sailors in New York.
Sure, yeah.
You know,
I don't get the sense that Peter a punch for Peter O'Toole would have a whole lot of impact. I don't get the sense he had a whole lot of muscle to throw a punch. But okay,
shredded those guys' clothes with the sword. Where I'm like, well, that's a little like Bugs Bunny, Looney Tunes.
Oh, here we go. There. And, oh God, this makes me happy. He finally spoke.
Finally get the mutes line.
Yep. Here we go. This is
great. Yeah.
Totally Batman the TV show. Yeah. Look at the. I love like the pose that Peter O'Toole does. It's very action guy. Look at that. Takes his sword back. There you go.
It's the moment, and it's for the character. Alan Swan has got an audience loving him, giving him all of this energy, and he's feeling all of this energy. And it's for me, it's this beautiful moment where, you know, he got what he needed. And, you know, Sid Caesar character here secretly really admires Alan Swan and is really happy that he's on his show.
You must have felt that, right, when you were doing the play? You're doing the musical? I mean, you get that live round of applause. It's amazing.
Oh, I loved it. I love the audience. Are you kidding? It's the best feeling. The best feeling, and you can see it on his face. It's something about his face is very sweet in this shot. Like his eyes are so telling a story. It's so blue and so much coming out of them.
Yeah, this is great. Even in the black and white, you can see it. You know, his eyes really.
I don't think he won the Academy Award for this, but
no, he did not.
You know who he lost to?
I think he lost to Ben Kingsley for Gandhi, maybe?
Oh, yeah, that's a hard one, too.
Yeah. I mean, he was also up against, I think, if this was all the same year, he was up against Paul Newman for The Verdict, and that movie's a masterpiece. So, I mean, I could see why, you know, he probably had zero chance. I think he got a Lifetime Achievement Award Oscar not that long before he passed away, and he apparently initially had sort of wanted to turn it down because he wanted to win it in proper competition. But then he said, no, I'll accept it, of course. Cause he never won. He never won. And there we go. And then there, Benji talks about that they went to see Tess the next day. And so he gets the
one loose thread that they need to wrap up there still is like, well, wait a minute. Did he see his daughter or not? To me, I'm like, somebody was making this. Maybe they had a scene that they shot and they were like, it's too much. We should end the movie there at the studio. We'll just put some voiceover in at the end and say, that it all worked out.
Do you think that's what it was? Do you think that was like a post-production kind of decision?
I bet you there was another scene, and I bet you it just ran a little long, and it wasn't as good a way to end it as it would have been to just end it on that awesome shot of him.
On the applause, yeah.
Yeah. That's my guess. I don't know if I could be totally wrong, but that's what it feels like, because it's a loose thread. That feels like too loose of a thread, that like if they introduced the daughter and you saw her for that one shot where she has no dialogue, she was meant to have another scene. My guess.
I like that. I like that he and Benji at least hung out together right after the show. They at least went to go see Tess. Like, I mean, obviously, you know, Alan goes off and goes back to his movie star life. But I like the idea that they stayed friends a little bit. You know, you get sort of like, oh, that's nice that they, it was more than just a friendship of opportunity. It was, oh, okay. You know, they did some things together. And in my mind, in the My Favorite Year canon, you know, they stayed friends. Every time Alan Swan came back to New York, he would visit Benji, who, of course, got promoted to full writer on the King Kaiser show and, you know, went on to have a good career. That's what I like to tell myself.
Benji Stone probably turned into, like, I don't know, somebody. Like
Larry Gelbart, maybe, you know, went on to produce other TV shows and become, you know, a famous comedy writer or stuff like that. So, yeah, why not? I like that they didn't, you mentioned that, said the relation, the love, the quote-unquote love story with Jessica Harper. They get into that scene, but then they really kind of drop it at a certain point, because that's not what the movie's about. The movie's about this friendship. That's the movie, you know?
It's like, it feels like it's a little, that plot line always just felt like it didn't also have a great conclusion to it. It doesn't have a purpose by the end of the movie. Like, because the movie's not about him and Jessica Harper. It's really not.
Oh no, I just saw in the credits there, it said Lord Jim scenes courtesy of so-and-so. So part of those clips with Peter O'Toole was just from a Peter O'Toole movie.
I've
never seen Lord Jim, so that must be, at the very least, some of the clips have to be from real Peter O'Toole movies. So, okay, that's cool. That's fun.
That's cool. That's such a funny detail. I never noticed that.
I didn't realize that until to this moment. So, well,
now every time a movie ends, I'm waiting for like the end tag to happen, because I just am now used to that. There's no Marvel end tag at the end of My Favorite Year.
My Favorite Year cinematic universe. So that's My Favorite Year. I mean, good Lord, he sailed right through it. And this was back when movies didn't need to be 2.5 hours. You know, movies could be 92 minutes and that was considered enough.
Hey, man, if you want to cover a Michael Bay movie, I can do that with you.
Oh, Lord. I've already done one Michael Bay movie.
We'll get beers if we do Michael Bay.
Oh, lordy, 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 lordy. I mean, you know what? I have said this, I think, on other Film and Waters, is that I like movies that are very short or are very long, because I feel like at this point, if you make a movie that's 3 hours, you really need to justify it being 3 hours. And I find that most movies, once they hit that length, they need to be that length, because they are telling such a huge story, whether it's Infinity War, or, you know, like Steven Soderbergh's Che, you know, like I sat through The Godfather, you know, and that's a much older film, obviously. But like, when I see a 3 hour movie, I very rarely get bored. But man, I've seen a lot of 2 hour and 20 minute movies that are way too long, you know?
Well, and that's, in my opinion, that's just where that's one of the harder parts of the process. When the film is at a length of about 2 hours and 20 minutes, and, you know, maybe the director feels like this is my film, this is all of my stuff, but there's still all this fat that you need to trim off of the movie, just that, you know, it's like killing your darlings, basically, where it's like, let's trim this off. Let's take, you know, the end of this scene out. It doesn't move things along. Let's take this transition out. It doesn't move things along. Like, and there's a way to make that movie that is 2 hours and 20 minutes, a 90 minute movie. Mm. You don't always get to, but, you know, unless there's something really happening, you want to make sure your movie is 90 minutes. Otherwise, it just feels really self-indulgent, like, unless you actually have a story that you're trying to tell. But if your shots are just long and artsy, you know, that's and I can just be an exercise in futility.
Yeah, I a lot of times when I open up a movie and I see, you know, and it's 142 minutes, I'm like, come on, you know. But man, if something's like 83, I'm like, oh, I'm in. I'm excited. This
you were
is great.
So excited when I gave you Changeland.
Yeah, right. Changeland. Very short. But again, it's if you could tell your story briefly. I don't. If I feel like I've gotten a complete story, I don't mind that it's short because it's like it's a complete story. You know, I walk away very feeling very satisfied. So yeah, my favorite year. It's a terrifically fun movie. It came out on October 8th, 1982. It was a relative success. It wasn't a huge hit. But it was enough of a hit that it was, you know, considered a success. And I mentioned Corey mentioned it got nominated for an Oscar. It debuted its first weekend. I just love this factoid. It debuted at number three behind, and the number one position was Officer and a Gentleman in its fifth week at release. And at number two was E.T. on its 18th weekend of release. That's how big E.T.
was. So different.
Yeah. Wow. Can you imagine any movie running 18 weeks nowadays? That's just not going to happen. It would be already on streaming by that point at 18 weeks. But E.T. was still churning.
There was no other way to watch it.
Number two. At number two, it was still making that kind of money. So
that's funny that my favorite year in its first week was number three, even though it was the only new movie that was probably coming out that week. Everybody still wanted to see
E.T. and
E.T. Or
Officer and a Gentleman.
Officer and a Gentleman more.
that says something about the diversity of movies. Those three movies are all completely different movies. I mean, that's, you know what I mean? Like nowadays it would kind of be like, well, in the number one position is this Marvel movie. And in the number two position was this other Marvel movie. And in number three was this Transformers movie. I mean, Officer and a Gentleman, E.T., and My Favorite Year have literally nothing to do with each other in any respect. And that's great. There's a lot of stuff out there for people to see. So, said it's a really fun movie. And I just had a blast talking about it, Corey. I mean, you picked this. And it was it hadn't been a movie I'd seen in a very long time. But boy, I had a lot of fun rewatching it. So thank you for doing this.
Hey, thank you. Maybe we can share a link to my high school production of it.
Absolutely. We'll that w- I will put that in the show notes.
Put that will in the show the, notes.
Yes, yeah. will be the there link to Corey Moose's musical number in the much more music of the musical. How many
my
chances?
First mustache.
How many chances do you really get to see one of the guests here on one of my podcasts in something, in a play? It's just amazing. So yeah, check out that. It'll be in the show notes, everybody. You got to make sure you check it out. So
that's so funny.
Yeah. So Corey, thank you once again. You know, I always enjoy talking to you and having you on the show. So thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you. My pleasure. Have a great day.
So everybody, thanks so much for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of Film and Water on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking movies over on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. If you like this show, check out my other movie-related shows here on the network. Fade Out, Superman 3 Movie Minute, which just concluded, and Citizen Kane Minute, which concluded as well. And then if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on show of your choice. So big thanks to Corey Moussa. Hey, that worked out. David Hiss Gutierrez and Gord Tolton for their support of the network. I very much appreciate it. So that's going to do it. Let us know what you thought of this commentary over on the website. Let us know if you've seen this movie and what you thought of it. I said it's a whole lot of fun. So again, everybody, thanks for listening. We will see you next time. But until then, that's a wrap.
You look great. How do you feel?
I feel surprisingly well, Stone. Thank you. So well that I'm going to make a prediction. Now, usually it takes me two or three takes just to warm up. But tonight, I predict, we'll get it on the first take.
We always get it on the first take. We have to.
You do?
Sure, this is live television.
Live. What does live mean?
It means at the exact moment you're cavorting and leaping around that stage over there, 20 million people are seeing it.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Mr. Swan, you're white.
You mean it all goes into the camera lens and then just spills out into people's houses?
Yeah.
Why has nobody had the goodness to explain this to me before?
It's nothing to worry about, Mr. Swan. Our audiences are great.
Audience? What audience? Audience?
You knew there was an audience. What did you think those seats were for?
I haven't performed in front of an audience for 28 years.
Audience?
I played a butler.
I had one line!
I forgot it.
But don't worry. This is going to be easy.
For you, maybe. Not for me. I'm not an actor. I'm a movie star!